Hello and welcome to episode 63 of Meenal's World. Thank you all for joining me again this week. Now, over the last couple of years, we've seen more conversations about masculinity and how that plays a role in gender equality and the notion that men and women should be treated equally. And it's something we've been fighting for decades and centuries. Now, my guest today, Dan Guinness, has been working on this over the last decade. He's been working on opening up connections and support for growth for men and boys through his organization Beyond Equality. And in this episode, we discuss how he built this organization and the nuances involved in getting men involved in conversations around feminism and how important it is to appreciate and empathize with people's cultural backgrounds. It was a really eye-opening conversation for me because I've realized how, as a doctor and as a mother, I can play a role in creating this change. And I'm really certain that this is going to help each and every listener today. And I know a lot of you will leave this episode with the wish to help Beyond Equality. They've helped over 40,000 people in the last couple of years. And I've left all the links that you need in the show notes below. So make sure you do check that out. So without further ado, here's Dan. Welcome to the show, Dan. It's lovely to finally get to speak to you. How are you doing?
I'm doing much better than when we tried to get together and speak for the first time. No, I'm doing well. I'm doing well. The sun is slowly starting to emerge and things are looking better.
Whereabouts are you based, Dan?
At the moment, I'm actually in Amsterdam. So I split my time between here and the UK.
What brings you to Amsterdam?
Well, originally, I got a placement out here doing some research. I was part of like this research group that was looking at masculinities around the world, and particularly within sports and within sports migration. And so it was a very niche topic, and this incredible opportunity came up to be part of this research team. And so I came out here for that in 2013. Then I finished that project, and I've now got a partner here. And so I'm sort of splitting my time between my life and obligations and everything else here, and my life and obligations and everything else in the UK.
Wow. What's the juggle like? I mean, I would imagine living in the Netherlands is quite different.
Yeah, it's very different. Also, I sort of do a bit of like couch hopping between different friends' houses and that sort of vibe when I'm in the UK. Which is wonderful because I get to see friends, which is sometimes a little bit hard when you get busy. But on the other side of things can also be a bit tiring. And, you know, you never know. I feel like I'm a conscientious guest, but you never know if you're pushing the limits a little bit and maybe have stayed one too many times. So I think actually this COVID period, in the same ways that for some people who have been able to be working from home, it's like opened up different problems and different opportunities. I think I've really experienced like a massive change in my, not only my lifestyle, but actually where I am, because I haven't been traveling back and forth, which, I mean, frankly, has been quite nice to avoid all that travel. I'm one of those rare people who are sort of holding on to the Zoom phone calls for as long as they possibly can.
Well, Dan, I got in touch with Beyond Equality, the team at Beyond Equality, a few weeks ago because I interviewed one of the ambassadors, Gina Martin. And on that show, we had some very interesting conversations about, you know, creating change and the intricacies involved in trying to create change at a grassroots level. And when I looked at your website, Beyond Equality, and I saw that you'd written that there's a need and an opportunity to create the way we think about masculinity. Now, just curious, so where do you think this opportunity came from, and what was it that sparked your idea?
Yeah, interesting. I think the opportunity doesn't come from us per se. I think there's all sorts of topics that are now on the radar in the UK and that like are in people's minds, whether it be the thoughts about mental health or the and well-being of men and how that links up to how they're socializing, how they're like connecting with each other, how they see themselves, understand themselves. But also now, particularly in the last couple of years, conversations around sexual violence and just being like, okay, hold on a second. This is a moment to look at what's that violent aspect that is in our society and that the majority of the time is being related to men. So I think the opportunity is the fact that those things are on the table, and the need is the fact that they've been there for a long, long, long time, those issues. And we really need to make the most of this opportunity to actually like make whatever changes we possibly can.
What was it like for you growing up, Dan? Because I mean, when I speak to, you know, the men in my life, especially from our sort of background and culture, South Asian culture, it almost seems like there's this big enlightening for the men in our generation, especially where they want to break this cultural like cycle of how men behave with their wives and with the women in their family. And it's very difficult to be that man, you know, to create that change. And I do believe it's all the influences around you, whether it's the women in your life or the family around you. But what was it like for you, Dan, to come up with this idea of creating this kind of change? Because it's like a huge thing to take on.
Yeah, well, I feel my story like with my family is probably different to the one that you're alluding to. Like in many ways, there were lots of men in my extended family who were already modeling to me very different ways of relating, particularly to their family, like caring and very emotionally literate. Also, many who aren't like that. And, you know, there's people in my family who face problems that are very associated with men and masculinities, things like alcoholism, those types of issues. So I did have some modeling, and that was there all through my life. I do remember some big changes that happened within me at various moments. And I think one of the key moments actually was my parents split up, and my mum at that point became really involved and active and outspoken as a feminist, and trying to rethink some of the values that she'd taken on and she'd had relating to, I mean, it's quite hard because it was also relating to my parents' marriage, but also relating to the church and those sorts of values that came down through the church, and the sort of life that she'd lived up to that point. And I think that was really impactful on me in all sorts of really positive ways, sometimes painful and difficult ways. And then there was a moment where I left Australia and came to the UK to study. And even just arriving there and being flung into a very slightly different culture and society, but one that was noticeably different in lots of ways. And it starts to bring stuff to the surface that probably existed to a similar extent in Australia, but just becomes really obvious when those little behaviors seem abnormal to you and you notice them. It's like, well, hold on a second. Like, why is people behaving like this? And I think it, for me, came across as a real sense of entitlement at times. And I'd see certain groups of men.
What kind of behaviors were they?
Like an unapologetic taking up of space and feeling like people could control space. And I think it was linked to being male, and it was also linked to certain class dynamics in the UK. And that was confronting. Like, I mean, in Australia, we definitely have class, but it's very hidden and it's like a taboo and you wouldn't speak about it. And we don't really understand, we don't have a language that relates to it exactly to understand it. Whereas it's so obvious in the UK, you know, and it cuts across different dynamics. And obviously it's complicated by, you know, by immigration status and by what sort of the way that people are racialized and lots of other dynamics, but that it is there and is really obvious for me arriving as an Australian. And I think that was something that brought a lot to mind. And it, in those moments where you're confronted by it, I think I was lucky enough that at that same time I was getting confronted by some of the people around me about my behaviors as well. You know, and this is now like a period of a few years where people would be saying like, okay, you're talking about this stuff, you know, you're obviously interested in feminism, but like, how are you showing up in your relationships? How are you showing up for us actually? Like, why are you still part of that club? Why are you still part of that group of people? Really challenging questions, but those sorts of things that got me thinking, and then realizing I'm really fortunate to have that opportunity and have those people in my life who are comfortable enough with me or brave enough to confront me and challenge me and help me grow and change. And then I could see that there was this space for a lot of men where they needed those conversations and they could really benefit and grow from them, but would just not have access to them, or would be resistant or defensive about them. And that's the opportunity or the need that we saw to step into, to try to create this initiative, just to get that space open. And that would be more, I guess, more tailored or feel like a better fit or whatever it was going to be to a group of men who wouldn't otherwise be involved in conversations about equality or violence prevention at all.
I wonder, Dan, what was it like? I mean, you talk about the changes that you wanted to implement on a personal level. And at that time, I mean, not in an offensive way, but like, internet wasn't as accessible as it is now. You know, we don't have access to information like you had, you know, in your time. How did you take the steps to create that change? I mean, what was your plan? And what did you do to say, okay, this is the person I am now, this is the person I want to be, and this is what I'm going to do to get there?
I don't know if I was so like sequential with my planning. No,
it was strategic.
Yeah, exactly. I think I just saw that there was some stuff that was coming up in my life that I felt that discomfort about, you know, and I was like, oh, there's something amiss here. You know, it's not, I feel, or I'm getting told that I'm not the person that I want to be. And that just needed something to, there was something that I needed to get explored, to be thought about. I wanted a solution to those things. And when they kept on popping up, then I kept on exploring different directions. And really, like, if we look back as an organization or as a person, the types of things that we're talking about now, or the types of topics that I'm interested in now, were not on my radar when this organization began 10 years ago. They weren't. I mean, they were important. I probably thought they were important, but they weren't there. They were like, oh, that's for someone else to deal with. It doesn't quite relate to this. And then as the conversation...
What kind of topics are they, Dan?
You know what? A really obvious one to me will be around homophobia. And I can remember that in one of our very first workshops, we did it for, it was like a pilot period, and we had some people come back and they're like, hey, we really think it's a great format. Like, we love what it's doing. It's very obviously leaning in really hard into the sexual violence prevention and gender equality. But they said that there was like this potential to also discuss like experiences of gay men and discrimination that they experience. And I remember at the time we had a conversation about it and we're just like, oh yeah, like that's a good topic, it's important, but that's not really to do with this, you know, it's a different thing. And then as we started to like go deeper and deeper into our work, and probably if we'd just done a bit more reading or something at the time, you know, those deep connections between the sorts of ways in which misogyny manifests itself and homophobia manifests itself, the way people, you know, it's projected, it's part of the same complex where people just are wanting to prove that they're not something else, you know, defining against the other, don't want to be emasculated by being associated with one of these groups that's somehow been cast as being less than. And so it's really deeply ingrained. And I think as we started doing our work, more and more times we can see that there's a valuable conversation about tackling homophobia that can come straight out of a conversation about gender equality and misogyny and vice versa. They're really, you know, they're really mutually useful conversations to be having. Like, they construct upon one another they intersect in lots of ways. So just as one example of something, I mean, overall, more or less, it's been a gradual becoming more aware of and comfortable with just how intersectional all of these conversations actually are and the practice of dismantling this actually is.
Yeah, that's really interesting because we always talk about intersectional feminism as one subject, but that intersectionality can be translated and transferred into other aspects of equality as well. And that's a really interesting point you've made. I've never really thought about it in that way. And just talking about how you're creating change and trying to understand different topics, and I would assume that sometimes these topics might be quite uncomfortable for you because, you know, when you're speaking to someone who's been through a traumatic experience and, you know, you're having to listen to that and understand that, it's very difficult to put yourself in their shoes, especially if you haven't lived that. Going back to what I was saying about trying to break those cultural barriers, because you want to engage men and boys from all classes of society. What's your angle in trying to understand that cultural difference? Because, I mean, I can quite safely say, Dan, like, if you had a chat with my dad right now, he'd have no clue what you're talking about. he'd be like, what are you talking about? Like, it's completely normal. But if you had, you know, if you had the same conversation with my brother, he'd understand what you're saying. So, you know, there's this like generational gap in understanding. What are you doing with Beyond Equality to understand these like very important nuances?
I think the key difference is what we're doing at the moment is I'm saying a lot of stuff. I'm sort of fumbling around a bit, but I'm kind of saying stuff directly. Like it's sort of a little bit in teacher mode, you know, it's like, here's my view on the world, blah, you know, take it, leave it, whatever, here it is. The way we actually create change or create the opportunity or the potential for change in our work is mainly in these workshops. And actually what we're trying to do there is really be curious about the lives of the people who are in the room, of the participants, of the men who are there. So it's not to say, hi, Mr. Fizz, I don't know, this is what you need to think about. You need to, here's this really interesting idea about gender equality you haven't considered before, or here's this idea about what it is to be a man that you should like pay attention to. Most of the time, and I think the really effective stuff is where like, okay, let's ask you some questions about, well, you know, what was it like for you when you were growing up? Like what kind of things were you told that you had to do because you were a boy, or you should never do because you're a boy? You know, what were those boxes that were getting drawn around you to fit into? And what was the parts of yourself that you gave up at those moments? How about now? How are those expectations showing up for you? You know, what's that pressure that you feel sometimes, or maybe like an inability to reach out and ask for help on certain topics, a fear of losing face, a fear of shaming yourself, shaming your family. I don't know. And people will have different relationships to that. They'll have different conversations. They'll have a different lens. You know, I think a lot of people have a very family-based lens to that, and like understanding themselves as having a very central and fixed role in their families. Feeling a lot of weight is on them. And if we can get people to have that curiosity to ask those questions and to see it from that perspective, we can start to get those social norms, those gendered stereotypes to a place where we can talk about them and then think about, okay, these are here. We're talking. We can recognize them. They're coming up through the conversation we're having. What are they doing? Like the impact of those and the way that we behave or the way that other men behave, can we see those links to the sorts of consequences there are for people in our lives, women in our lives, men in our lives? Just normal society, regular society, broader society as well. So that's the route in. It's one of like exploration. It's one of curiosity. I do sometimes give presentations and have to kind of just reel things off. And there you have to be very careful about choosing your entry point as well, because there's a lot of words at the moment in society that are quite, for want of a better word, like triggering of a lot of ideas, and you get like an ideology that sort of flood out, or an insecurity or a fear. And sometimes it can feel like a sort of tiptoeing around and, you know, trying to dodge those tricky topics or those words. I remember for a long time we avoided at all costs using the word feminism, even though internally that's exactly how we were thinking about ourselves. But we knew if we started a conversation with the word feminism, many of the men in the room would be like, yeah, that's about women attacking men, and would instantly put up a wall. Now we find we can come at that from a place and go, what do you think of this word feminism? And then they'll go, oh, that's about women attacking men. And then we can talk about that. And, you know, again, get it to the surface, figure out where the idea comes from, hopefully get people to move past it.
Well, it was really great to hear, Dan. I really love the holistic approach you have in educating people. And it's more about sort of planting the seed and getting people to think about what these things mean to them. Considering that we've spent a good proportion of our life in school where we just have to memorize things and parrot it out, that learn, I mean, I talk about it all the time. I really think learning is so, means so, so much more different to me than what it did 10 years ago. It's not about sitting in a classroom. Learning and understanding the world has a completely different meaning to me now. And I think it's really great that you open up these conversations. And it's, I guess a lot of it is about building that rapport as well, you know, with the people that you're speaking to. And I see that as a doctor as well. Like, I can't just convince someone to stop eating chocolate if they're diabetic. You know, it's about building that rapport and understanding and having that, willingness to understand, you know, their feelings and their emotions based on what they have. What's been the most challenging thing for you, Dan? Because, I mean, your approach seems like ideal. It's like, sounds like that would be perfect and it would work every time, 100% of the time. But I'm sure you must have hit some roadblocks at some point and thought, well, how do we tackle this issue?
Throw the whole thing away and walk off. Yeah. you're asking the tough ones. What have been the moments that I've got most frustrated? I think the really hard stuff tends to be outside of the workshops. It's in finding people, finding enough resources so that we can actually get facilitators to be in front of them, getting the time in like a school calendar or a sports team calendar, a university calendar, where there's like, okay, we can give this 2 hours to have this discussion, and we can come back in a few weeks and have another discussion. You know, that side of stuff is where the frustration is and where the difficulty is. You know, and I'm probably not very good at marketing naturally. So I'm way too laid back for it. And that side I find difficult and frustrating. And then along with like lots of financial pressures and, crisis meetings with treasurers and stuff like that. But I think the more interesting thing for you and your listeners will be the sort of obstacles that come up in workshops that are difficult. I think the most challenging things that we're having, that I've had over the years, is when someone, without me having anticipated beforehand, gets into a space where they're reliving or experiencing somehow the traumas that they've had before. Because we are careful, and we're getting more and more careful about realizing that no matter what the group in front of you is, it's very likely that someone there, either themselves or a close family or friend, has had a really negative experience of the sort of topics we're talking about, like sexual violence or domestic violence or discrimination of a whole different range of things. That experience is there and it can get brought up, and it can then be, initially, I think that's just emotionally a very difficult space to be trying to hold for someone, make sure that they're as safe as they can be and they've got some support and direction afterwards, and at the same time also holding space for the other people in the room, ideally so that, you know, one person doesn't become a spectacle, but the conversation can either move along or pause or go in a different direction or whatever it needs to do, but sort of creating those spaces. And I think because we've got a lot of experience now in handling these conversations, we do know the moments where these things are more likely to come up. you anticipate them and preempt them and try to provide that space. It's still really difficult when it does. And it can be really very impacting on you as an individual. I mean, obviously more so on the person, but as a facilitator of that conversation, it's hard. And then the other difficult thing is when you walk into a room and you can just tell that there's someone there who's not there to be there. They're there to like just ruin the whole thing. And it happens rarely, but you can pick it a mile off because there'll be like a kind of angry looking person with their arms crossed. And you've just said hello friendly and like, you're like, oh, I don't know what's going on here, but I don't think it's going to be a fun day. And it doesn't happen all that often. It does happen. And they've normally just like, they've normally been down like a YouTube rabbit hole and they've tapped, which has tapped into a lot of pain and frustration that they have, and given them a framework to understand that. And then that framework says that anything to do with equality or question these ideas of masculinity is actually an attack on them as an individual. And that's an okay conversation to have with someone, but it's a very difficult dynamic, again, to manage for the rest of the group. As we've got, and when you have one person who's just trying to derail everything, and then the rest of the people who are trying to like gradually get stuff to the surface. It's a challenging thing to handle.
Mm. And why do you think people behave in that way, Dan? People who come into the conversation, sort of people who come in with that pre-notion, okay, I'm going to go in and I'm going to prove myself right. I'm going to prove that these guys are wrong. And where do you think that aggression comes from? Because I feel those are probably the people who have the most trauma.
Yeah, I think you're right. Like it really does. It does often come from a place of frustration. It's a range of people, right? Like broadly speaking, you might describe that area of thinking as being within the manosphere. And within that, there's lots of different lines of thinking and degrees of extremity and various other things. But for me, a lot of it at its core does just come back to that experience of being told a lot that you should be something that you're not and not quite being given a place in society. And then having like this sort of big lack of connection with the story that's being told to you that men have advantages and privileges and that women are the people who are suffering in our society and discriminated against, and being like, oh, hold on a second, like, I don't feel like I have any privilege or any advantages. I feel like I'm down the bottom of the pecking order. I feel like maybe women in my life or at school when I was growing up or everywhere else have laughed at me and, you know, discounted me rather than me doing it the other way. I think there's lots of those feelings that might have come up through personal experience, and all of which are very genuine, true feelings and probably coming from experiences which in themselves are also valid and true, but just missing this broader picture about what else is going on. And I think this is why talking about things in an intersectional way, in a way that's nuanced, is crucial, because you're then able to help someone understand, well, there's this framework here, which is like, yes, you've experienced suffering. You still are experiencing suffering. You haven't had advantages that other people have had. And at the same time, there are other groups of people who, you know, have systems of that, those types of oppression or discrimination, you know, geared against them. And it's that balancing of that personal narrative and experience with that broader structure in society is a difficult thing to get to. And it's like, because of that difficulty, a lot of people don't, you know, can't reconcile that and actually need space to like put those couple of things together. I feel like I'm sort of just like rambling on too much.
No, so, not at all.
I feel the other group of people kind of come from a perspective that I find most commonly have come from a perspective, which is sort of they would understand as being like a, almost like a hyper-rational type of approach. And they're very interested in a couple of studies that show what they believe show an evidence that gender inequality is not a real thing, or that men are actually disadvantaged. And there's a line of frameworks and I guess ideologies as well, which they will enter into, which it's not so much coming from a position of trauma or pain or suffering. It seems to be way more coming from a position of having had a good education, got to a good place in life, having had a lot of privileges, and then feeling really, really challenged and defensive when someone points out some of those advantages that you've had, and going, hold on a second, I'm going to prove you wrong here. And I think that's the other group of people who come into workshops. And I'm very compassionate towards the first group. I think there's a lot of ways you can work and benefit from the sort of workshops we do. Whereas I think the second group, when they come in, it's really hard to engage with them because they don't want to do these questions around exploration. They want to kind of impose a very rigid framework that they believe, you know, proves what they're saying to be true.
But do you have that time within a workshop, Dan, to encourage people to explore? Because I personally think that's like years of work that goes into creating that change. So how do you try and sort of condense all those years of hard work into a 2-hour workshop? Or is it possible, is my question?
Yeah, it's not possible, right? It's absolutely not possible. And what we know to be possible, though, is to shift some people and shift a group culture and actually create new conversations. So, and ultimately what we're trying to do and what we do a lot of times is come back to the same group of people or the same place year on year on year on year. And you really start to see like a change in the way in which people approach different conversations when that happens. So there is something about getting the dosage or getting the amount of time with each other to a high enough point. And there's something else, which is just like that moment of interruption, that moment of disruption that can be really, it can be a catalyst for further changes. So if all we do is get some of those ingrained biases and whatever else up to the surface and have people have like that moment of being like, oh, hold on a second. Yeah, that does seem like it's not quite right. You know, I shouldn't take that for granted anymore. Maybe I can start questioning some of this that's around me, and that's like a positive experience for me and something that could be like exciting and liberating for me and for other people. If we can get a group of people to have that experience as individuals and as a group together, that is a big opportunity and big step forward, and it can kickstart something else.
Mm.
But no, we're not miracle workers.
Yeah, no, I completely appreciate that, Dan. And I think that's one of my biggest issues as well when I work in the hospital as a doctor. You want to go the extra mile for every single patient. You want to do everything you can. And in my head, I have like that plan. I know what I can do if I had that time, if I had that energy, if I had the resources. But unfortunately, I mean, I personally don't. And I'm sure with your work that you're doing as well, because you're trying to mold your work, I assume, within the school curriculum. You're trying to mold your work into a pre-existing system that's been there for years and decades that you're trying to change. So I understand how difficult that can actually be. But Dan, do you have any experience in teaching at all? Because Beyond Equality is all about teaching. Is this what you've been doing your whole life, or is this just something that you dropped on yourself?
In a way, I disagree with you, which is, yeah. Like I think one of these, you know, maybe it's like a petty point, right? But
it's okay. We've got time, Dan. We can go on forever. It's okay.
I mean, you're right. You're on the money in lots of ways. And I think for us, Sometimes what we do is actually make the contrast between, hey, what do you do when you're facilitating one of our sessions versus what do you do when you're trying to teach someone something? And it's a shift in terms of the power dynamics of the facilitator slash teacher and the participants. You know, like it's more of a collaborative space in which you're sharing ideas and you're trying to work on things together, as opposed to having one person who's the source of knowledge who's then trying to translate that to another group of people. Which we do sometimes. You definitely, like, it's nice when you can just download, like, hey, here's a really neat, easy, clear, straightforward and useful framework to understand this really complicated issue, right? Let me explain it to you in 2 minutes. But that's really effective after you've had that conversation that's brought that stuff to the surface. So, but to answer your actual question, teaching, yeah, I mean, you can see I slip into teacher mode all the time, like right now. And I've not done any training as a teacher, like in terms of school teaching or anything like this. I was a university lecturer and judo and a rugby coach for many years. And growing up, I mean, I was a big nerd growing up. So I used to get the job of like tutoring the neighborhood kids and that sort of stuff to, for pocket money. So, those sorts of things have been in my life. And not my whole family, but a huge number of my family are teachers. So it's sort of ingrained in the DNA or whatever it is, the legacy of the family or those little lessons that you get when you're growing up.
Daniel, you meant there's quite a lot on Beyond the website of Beyond Equality about masculinity in sport. And I wanted to touch upon that a little bit because rugby, you mentioned you were a rugby coach, and that is, you know, quite a heavy sport. It's not, it's probably one of the most male dominated ones. What kind of things were you seeing in that specific area of sport where you felt that a change had to happen?
Yeah, interesting. I've got such a strange relationship to rugby in so many ways because I always kind of like step in to defend it. Because in a way, when I look back, I can see how it taught me to be violent at times, like really violent, you know, and violent also towards myself, like to suppress fear and pain that I had, literally, you know, playing through injuries and all of that sort of thing. And yet at the same time, I don't necessarily think that that there is like a direct relationship between the nature of the sport and the sort of culture that can kind of like emerge around it. And I think I say that because I also had such like complex experiences where in some of the locker rooms that I was part of, yeah, some of them were super misogynistic and very objectifying of women and very kind of machismo in terms of the competition between different people. And then many other places I've gone to have been extremely caring and kind and sweet and have discouraged like violent resolution to conflict and have really seen the game as having those elements, including elements of physical intimidation, but that being somehow separate from who you are and your character. And so I find it like it's a fascinating question for me. Because I can see that sport has this ability to bring people in and connect different people to each other and can provide challenges and discipline and direction and encouragement and support and community that can actually really help give people a base for having a better identity in life and connection to other people. Or it can encourage and be a space for like the absolute worst parts of the society. You know, I mean, we see, which I think get come to the fore and sort of the bubbling over of all the excusing of racist taunts or homophobic slurs or those types of things where it's like, oh yeah, that's fine, like, because it's that person's on that team, you know, and that real, I don't know, really horrible stuff that can emerge in that space. So it's an interesting question. I guess I get challenged a lot also personally to reflect upon on how much I still enjoy the game and the sport and still find huge amounts of connection to my teams and people I've played with, even as I do a lot of my work in critiquing some of the structures and critiquing some of the cultures and attitudes that were common in those spaces. So, yeah, I don't know. It's a fascinating one for me.
Yeah, because, again, it's one of those things where you have to look at so many different angles in the sport itself, because the sport is quite an aggressive sport. But then how do you take that aggression out emotionally and, you know, try channel that aggression physically in the sport? It's a very difficult thing. Because I remember, Dan, when I used to row competitively. I was going to say professionally, definitely not professionally.
not many professional rowers, yeah.
It was competitively that I used to row. And I remember we were out on the boat one day, and the other boat we were competing with, they just turned around to us, and because we won the race, and they said, "Oh, you all look really butch." You know, being strong as a woman, being strong as a female in a sport doesn't necessarily mean I have to look a certain way. And that always stuck in my head. I don't know why. And maybe this is something I should unpack, as in, what does it actually mean to be a strong woman? And that was one thing that happened to me, but I can't imagine what it must be like for men playing things like rugby or, you know, sports which can be quite aggressive, boxing, to have this expectation that you have to look a certain way, you have to behave a certain way outside of the boxing ring or outside of the rugby pitch.
Yeah, I mean, it feels to me that there's a lot of that policing of other people's bodies and like making sure people fit into these like stereotypes. And you know, it feels to me a lot like what that crew was kind of intuitively trying to do, was like regain their supremacy over you by saying, "Hey, yeah, you beat us in the race, but we're the real women."
Yeah.
That's really common in lots of different sports, because there's such an attention to the body, and the bodies maybe can't be hidden as much or camouflaged as much. You know, say like if you're in fashion or something like this, or in the business world, maybe those types of elements are not emphasized so much. Where there's a lot to worry about when people become very self-judgmental and very obsessed with trying to conform and change themselves so that they look like or are perceived to be like somebody else, you know, or like this ideal type. I think this idea of body image or also just conforming to gender norms can be really prevalent within sport and also within like the fitness world even more so. And it can lead to eating disorders. It can lead to a lot of senses of just inadequacy and failure and judgment of one another. You know, huge scrutiny of just like looking in the mirror and being and feeling like I'm not good enough. And I don't know. I feel that for me going through my life, I've had a few moments where I've really experienced those sorts of feelings a lot. Growing up, I was very skinny, not so tall, and I kind of had this growth spurt, and I was all of a sudden very tall and a little bit skinny, but not as skinny as I used to be. But then when I got into the world of professional rugby, essentially for 5 years, is that right? Maybe a few less, maybe 3 or 4 years, every single day of my life was kind of built around eating constantly and going to the gym as much as I possibly could, because no matter how many kilos I put on, and I put on about 70 pounds or, you know, 35 kilos over the course of a few years of muscle, you know, and no matter how many I put on, I was always, you know, a couple of kilos less than what I should have been. And I think then I carried that body image through. And I was actually the moment that it wasn't really challenged when I was in the UK, in the circles that I was moving in, there was quite a high value given to very large men. And then I shifted and moved to Amsterdam. And I noticed actually that the way that people judged my body in Amsterdam was really vastly different. And I felt this like weird thing where people would be, I lost a lot of weight. So I'd stopped training, my lifestyle changed. And I like felt constantly like I was losing who I was, and I was losing my manhood, or like I was no longer attractive, or how could anyone think I was? I felt that all of that had kind of disappeared. And then I was getting comments coming from other directions of like, oh, you're looking so much healthier and so much better now. And it's been a dissonance there that I've felt when I've arrived in those spaces that have had like a different value of what an ideal body could look like or should look like or should be able to do. And I hope and I try to focus more on things like how my body's feeling and what it can do for me and how I'm treating it and things like this rather than how it looks. But I still, you know, I think these are things that we get sucked back into.
I also think, Dan, that for me at least, a really frustrating thing is that society's requirements for how a woman should look or how a man should look change all the time. And like, if we just look at even within our lifetime, you know, we've gone from actresses in Hollywood being really super skinny to now everyone celebrating even plus size bodies and those women who are curvy. And, you know, I think it's understanding as well that ultimately it's just an opinion, and ultimately the work has to come from with how you feel and having that sort of internal sense of satisfaction and that internal happiness, because everything that we put our happiness to in this generation, at least, is all external. Is what do people think? What do people want? What do people think is cool? And there's less of an emphasis on actually what do you want? And I think through your workshops, you're tackling that aspect, which is actually what happened to you when you were younger? What are the things that you want to see changing? And I think we need to have more of these conversations. Something as simple as actually, what do you want? What makes you happy? Because we don't think about that enough, Dan. And I don't think that we can even think about creating change within ourselves unless we have that very first important conversation about what we want internally, because everything else after that, I think, just rolls on quite naturally.
I mean, you're 100% right, I feel. And you're doing a very good job of describing it. Okay.
It's not on purpose, by the way. I'm not like trying to sell anything here, but if you do want to join the workshop, then go for it. Like, I'll put all the links on the show notes.
Yeah, exactly. I know you're right, and I talk about this and I think through this, and still I find it hard to have that first moment of sometimes getting in touch with like, what do I actually want? What's my desires? And what's just stuff that I think that I have to do? And I think for quite some time, a lot of those pressures were about like how I looked or how people would judge me. And now I'm finding there's a shift in me, and I guess it's like a life stage shift, and there's a lot more around like what responsibilities should I have and am I lifting up to those expectations? And I think, you know, it kind of boils down to the same thing that you're talking about, like what do I want and who am I? And it's the same kind of like question that will solve those problems. But it's, yeah, I don't know. It's sometimes easier to see that from the outside or see that in hindsight. So it's nice when you can get that space to have a wonderful conversation with you today, yeah, or with other people, with your friends, to actually look into
that. And Dan, the reason I say this is because I have had these moments of realizations pretty much through quite traumatic experiences, when life forces you to think, life forces you to create a change. And for me personally, it's been, you know, when I had my baby in almost 2 years ago. That for me was a life-changing moment. I wouldn't say it was a traumatic experience, but it was a difficult experience. Another time before that was when I took the British government to the court. But that was traumatic and emotional and everything. because it was very scary. But it was these moments that changed everything for me. Actually, what am I trying to achieve from what I'm doing? And what does that mean to me as an individual? Have you had any moments like that at all, Dan, since, not just necessarily through Beyond Equality, but before that, that made you think, actually, what do I want to achieve in my life and what are my goals?
Many of those moments. I mean, one really profound moment for me was when I went through a period over a couple of years where I started getting back injuries, and it's what ended my, well, I guess my not so illustrious career as a rugby player. But and I had four surgeries over the course of a few years, and some of them pretty major ones. And I think there was these confronting moments where I was in recovery and I was incapable of doing so many things for myself, and I had to rely upon other people. And that was frustrating and slow at times and painful and tiring. And then also what I really struggled with was when there was moments that I would be like in a social situation, I felt that, again, who I was had just disappeared. And instead of being the tall guy who was kind of at the center room with people buzzing around them, I was in the corner, sat by myself. I kind of felt people came to speak to me. It was out of pity. And I struggled with grappling with this new identity that I had as no longer being the person who could like lift heavy things and be strong and I don't know, I guess like fit into that protector model. And instead requiring and other people to help me and asking for help. And I think that was a moment in my life which was very traumatic. I didn't realize it at the time because I don't think I was so frightened about going into surgery. But I think it was the trauma for me happened afterwards when I was confronted by what I couldn't do and who I no longer was and things like this. And it really made me question what were the aspects of me that I'd become dependent upon to value and for my sense of self-worth. Mm. I think that's been like a really big moment in my life. That's called a lot of things into question.
Dan, I feel like I feel like I've put so many things in your head right now that you're not going to sleep tonight. I feel like I'm going to make you question everything about life now. I can just see in your face, like, oh God, I've got a lot to think about now about life. But I think for me, at least, like these kind of conversations are really important to have because they're just sort of small reminders of what we're doing and why we're doing everything that we set our minds to. Because we live in a world where everything is just all about go, go, go. You want to achieve the next thing. And it's so easy just to forget the why of everything that you're doing. And I know with Beyond Equality, you guys have had a huge impact across not just the UK, but different parts of the world. And it's truly incredible to see the change that, you know, you're capable of creating. But what does having an impact mean to you, Dan? Like, what is your vision? What do you want to see from everything coming out of this?
Yeah, I would love to see that there's more open and honest conversations between groups of people who are just not having those conversations. And my part of the work is to try to get men involved. And I'd love it. I'd absolutely love it if it was just like given a bit more space around the sorts of places that men are currently hanging out with each other to actually have some real honest conversations with each other. That for me would be like a huge impact. You know, these conversations where they actually like think about what it might be to be somebody else, where they talk about what it is to be them, what these questions are, what these fears that they have. Because what I see in like the feedback forms or the comments we get at the end of workshops is so often people are saying, hey, I've been on this team with these group of guys for 5 years or 2 years or 1 year. We've never had an honest conversation about sex and relationships before. Like I've never spoken about my mental health. I've never spoken about my fears or how I feel sometimes like really on the edge, like really on the margins, really excluded. That's never come up. And it was just wonderful that for a moment it came up. And for me, a really profound and valuable and satisfying impact would be that those conversations just open to far more people. And yeah, that's what we're working towards.
And Dan, if people want to get involved with Beyond Equality, I know you guys have lots of schemes where people can come in and be part of this incredible work. What's the best way to get in touch?
Best way to get in touch would be follow us on our social media or go check out our website. You can find pretty much all those things by looking up. Yeah, the ways to get involved would be, hey, get us in to have a workshop with your workplace, with your school, with your university. You can join our volunteer community. I'm kind of excited about it because I think in the past, what we've said is like, hey, the purpose of being a volunteer is to facilitate these workshops with other people. So we'll train you up and you'll go in front of like schools or universities and you'll have this conversation and you talk to people and, you know, a sports team will react in this way. That'll be your contribution. And what we're doing now is actually thinking about ways in which people who maybe don't have the time or skill sets to have a conversation with 15-year-olds can still like make a big difference and make a big contribution. Doing things like even just like starting some of these small conversations with their friends or learning how to check in different ways, or perhaps sharing content or creating content on social media, or even just they themselves starting this journey of thinking and reflecting and supporting the other people who are part of our community who are doing the same thing. You know, that's a massive contribution. Like if you just show up and you have that honest conversation with somebody else, you've done them a world of good and also yourself. So I'm excited about that prospect of having lots of different avenues where people can actually be making this contribution. Because the wonderful thing that we're seeing is that there are many men who do want to get involved in this and are interested in rethinking masculinities and seeing what sort of possibilities and potential lies on the other side of that.
Wow, that's amazing, Dan. Thank you so much for joining me today and just being really open and honest about everything. I really do appreciate it. I know it's not easy to dig deep into your past because it's not nice sometimes, but I really appreciate everything that you've said today. So thank you.
Oh, it's an absolute pleasure. You do a very wonderful job. So thank you for having me.
And thank you, dear listeners, for tuning in. Remember, if you listen to this episode on iTunes, please do leave a review. It will really help us reach out to more people. And as always, share this with your friends and family and share the word about Meenal's World, because we've got some incredible guests who I'm sure will help so many different people on their journeys in creating change and personal growth and development. Remember, you can also follow me at Dr. Meenal Viz on all social media channels. And you can also subscribe to my newsletter on my website, meenalviz.com. Thank you all again, and I'll see you all next Friday.